Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Hey, you, corporate America, how you doing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 26th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We're going to do a mood check, I guess you'd say, for the top of the program today. Looking at companies and corporations, though, instead of consumers, as we usually do. Our barometer of choice on this Wednesday are those quarterly earnings reports we all hear so much about. They can tell us how a company's feeling, to torture the metaphor just a little bit, but also they can give us a sense of what the economy's doing now and maybe will be doing in the short-ish term future. So here are a couple. Alphabet, which is to say Google, reported disappointing profits yesterday. Revenue growth was down hard from 41% growth year on year last year to just 6% this year. Meta, which is to say Facebook, said this afternoon that third quarter net income off more than 50%, 50% compared to last year. But then again, the payroll processing company ADP reported higher earnings today, which is kind of a surprise. So, Marketplace's Sabri Benishor does what he does best, reads some tea leaves.
So far this earnings season, most S&P 500 companies that have reported beat revenue expectations.
I think that the mood for the reports has generally been positive.
Alex Zukin is a managing director at Wolf Research.
I think it's the outlook that is giving people a little bit of hesitation.
The outlook is the part of the earnings report where companies tell you what they think is going to happen down the road. Microsoft, for example, suggested decelerating demand for some of its products, Zukin says. Some other red flags Zukin sees are companies that are suddenly focusing on cost cutting.
How do we make sure that every dollar that we're spending is being spent in the right way?
Or when companies are slowing down hiring.
Those two things are generally an ominous sign.
And there is a telling difference between the companies that have negative outlooks or bad earnings and those that don't.
It depends who you're selling to.
Michael Walker is an analyst at Alliance Bernstein.
If you are selling to consumers or if you are dealing with consumers and individuals, you're doing just fine so far. And in fact, the outlooks are pretty good for next year.
The job market is in good shape, so it's not too surprising that payroll processor, ADP, beat expectations.
On the flip side, if you're selling into companies, you are starting to see a downturn.
Google, Microsoft, and Texas Instruments each had forecasts that disappointed. All three companies sell to businesses. It's businesses that are starting to feel the teeth of rising interest rates. Rising rates make borrowing harder. They lower stock prices.
It does come in waves.
Joel Prakken is chief U.S. economist with S&P Global Market Intelligence.
We've seen, for example, that the housing sector is the first sector to respond by contracting.
Next, he says business spending on equipment will fall.
Somewhere in the mix there, you're going to see a drop off in spending for consumer durable goods.
And all of that will start showing up in earnings reports as time goes on. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Another entry in today's litany of bummer earnings calls, Boeing. The aerospace company told investors this morning it lost $3.3 billion just last quarter. CEO David Calhoun said defense contracts were mostly to blame. And also, he said that turnarounds take time. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more now on what that turnaround might look like and how much time investors might be willing to give.
Turns out making an airplane takes a lot of parts, which means a lot of manufacturers need to provide those parts when you need them. Samuel Engel is a senior vice president with the consulting firm ICF.
You can think of it almost like a spring unwinding, that you have one small supply chain shortage at level 3, which turns into a bigger supply chain shortage at level 2, and then suddenly you're missing an engine for a new 737 MAX.
Engel says Boeing is struggling with its supply chains like everyone else.
But when Boeing struggles with supply chain challenges, it's very expensive.
Boeing CEO said the biggest hit the company took last quarter is on defense plane contracts. They have fixed price points, which means Boeing can't just tell the customer, in this case the U.S. government, that it needs to pay more because of inflation.
And as everybody who's went to the grocery store or the gas station lately, you can tell that prices have really jacked up quite high.
That's Art Wheaton at Cornell University.
And unfortunately for Boeing, they can't pass along those price increases.
But it's not all bad news for Boeing. The company said it generated almost $3 billion in cash in the third quarter, which means it will likely end the year with positive cash flow. Richard Abulafia is managing director of Aerodynamic Advisory.
The good news is that the commercial aviation recovery is quite strong, so demand is heading up too.
Abulafia says demand for aircraft is certainly there. Whether Boeing has the capacity to keep up with that demand is unclear at this point. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little up, a little down, and way down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Come Friday, we'll get another reading on consumer spending in this economy. September data is what it's going to be. And seeing as how we are just about on the cusp of the holiday shopping season, we figured it might be good to hear from some of our retail regulars to get a sense of how that consumer economy looks from the other side of the cash register. First up is Philip Rollins. He's the proprietor of Offbeat. That's a record and comic book store just getting settled in its new spot in downtown Jackson, Mississippi.
The holidays haven't really started yet, won't really start till right before Black Friday. But everything is pretty much in stock. All my distributors are, you know, keeping me posted on when things are ready to ship. As far as cost, there hasn't been a big change per se. We've kind of minimized costs by switching to a new printer for our apparel line. Everything else has pretty much stayed kind of the same since last month, as far as with records and comics and the toys. Everything stayed the same. For the next month for the shop, I just, you know, I want to see how things go. I'm still kind of getting settled in at the new location. We only been open a week now. I'm really looking forward to seeing what the future holds for us here at this location.
That was Philip Rollins, now in downtown Jackson, Mississippi. Two more dispatches coming up later on in the program. Here's a data point from the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Census Bureau by way of setting up this next piece. New home sales in this economy fell nearly 11% September from August. Also, a big slowdown in the pace of housing price increases. See also rising mortgage rates. Now, given that, the numbers from Miami might surprise you. Last month, Miami-Dade County saw yet another double-digit annual price increase. And according to the Miami Association of Realtors, the median home price there has been rising for 130 consecutive months. That is despite Miami being one of the most vulnerable cities in the world to sea level rise. By the end of this century, entire parts of Metro Miami could be underwater. So here's the question that Amy Scott's been asking in the new season of How We Survive. If rising seas are coming from Miami, why isn't the housing market there acting like it?
To get to the bottom of this, I visited real estate agent Dina Goldentayer back in May at her office in Miami Beach.
Come on in. Welcome. This is
Thank
our
you.
Little humble abode.
Dina is an agent with Douglas Elliman. She specializes in ultra-luxury properties, anything above $10 million.
At the very top end of my current listings is a home on Indian Creek Village, which is known as America's Billionaire Bunker.
Dina sells waterfront property, so you might think she and her clients would be wary of the encroaching seas. The nonprofit First Street Foundation says 60% of properties in Miami are at risk of being severely affected by flooding in the next 30 years. But Dina says it's just not the driving conversation.
The timing of the issue does seem far off, Whereas then people are thinking about things more closer in time, like my kids are graduating school, I'm going to be an empty nester, or I'm selling my company for $500 million and I would like to have Florida residency. While I certainly don't want to downplay it, it's just not a question that I'm posed often.
After talking with Dina, I toured a handful of coastal properties and heard the same thing over and over again from other agents. People really want to live here. People like Lisa Reeves.
When did you move here?
6 weeks ago.
The one-bedroom condo she's renting in a downtown high-rise was about to go on the market for $850,000. Lisa graciously let me tour the space.
Oh, wow, look at that bathtub. It's huge.
Lisa moved here from New York.
I was there 27 years, and it was time for a change. The taxes in New York were extremely high.
Florida has no income tax. It's one of the big draws for a lot of people. Lisa is looking to buy, but wants to wait until the market cools down.
What about sea level rise? You know, Miami is obviously right on the water, and people are predicting...
So I'm in my 50s. So for me, I'm not that concerned about it. I'd be concerned if I left it for my daughter, for example. It's a slow thing.
Rising seas are already bringing higher storm surge along the coast, and so-called sunny day flooding during high tides is getting more common. Because Miami is built on porous limestone, the water doesn't just crash over seawalls, it seeps up from underground. So to hear real estate agents and hopeful buyers basically shrug, it left me with some questions. Does that surprise you?
No, that's exactly what we found. That's exactly what we found.
Risa Palm is an urban studies professor at Georgia State University. She recently surveyed almost 700 real estate agents in South Florida about how sea level rise was affecting the market. And they said it really wasn't. I mean, their business is to sell real estate. But even when Risa showed coastal homeowners maps of their neighborhoods and what flooding could actually look like in the coming years, they didn't really flinch.
People in Florida have had every reason to be optimistic because the housing market has been very hot. People who try to sell houses are getting multiple offers. They're getting offers over the price that they're asking.
Whether that will continue after Hurricane Ian hit the other side of the peninsula is unclear. But when you look at the highest end of the market, those ultra-luxury houses on the beach...
So a lot of people can simply throw their money away because they can afford to.
Jesse Keenan is an associate professor of real estate at Tulane University. He says even if people can afford to take on the risk that comes with coastal living, it's actually not just their problem.
It has impacts for all of us and all of the people in Miami and South Florida because you have to pay for the infrastructure to support those properties. And that infrastructure is increasingly becoming very, very expensive.
Infrastructure like pumping stations and elevated roads. Then there's the rising cost of disaster relief. When a hurricane or a big flood hits, taxpayers end up footing a lot of the bill. Nearly 40% of the U.S. population lives near the coast. And when we keep building and investing in housing that's increasingly in harm's way, we all end up paying for it. In Miami, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You just cannot fit the whole Miami housing climate change story into 4 minutes and 50 seconds, no matter how good Amy Scott and her team are. So check out the second season of our podcast, How We Survive. A new episode out today, by the way. It is available, of course, on the platform of your choice. Irene Kesselman's up next on our hit parade of retailers. She runs Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina.
I have hired most of my holiday staff. I still need to hire two more people. We definitely will have more people this year than we did last. Regarding costs, there definitely have been increases. I would say across the board, there are some things I definitely have to increase, and there are things that I may decide not to pass it on the customer, not to take a bigger markup and just to essentially eat it. I have seen, however, whereas a lot of us have been paying exorbitant freight for the past couple of years, just in the past couple of weeks, two vendors in particular state that they will be dropping the surcharge that they have charged for the past year and a half, effective in 23. So that's a good thing.
Irene Kesselman, Alley Cat Toys, Carrboro, North Carolina. One more retailer coming up in a little bit. Straight ahead.
We are physically ready for the holidays. Maybe not mentally.
Yeah, no, me neither. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials. Pretty much flat today, 31,839. The NASDAQ subtracted 228 points, 2%, ended at 10,970. The S&P 500 down 28.7%, 38.30 there. Talked about corporate earnings season a little bit, as Sabri was telling us. Google parent Alphabet unplugged more than 9% after the company missed expectations. Microsoft's report also did not compute. It fell 7.7%. Andy Euler was looking at Boeing. They landed down 8.7% today. But over in another transportation lane, easy riding for motorcycle maker Harley Davidson. Y'all know the ticker symbol, right? H-O-G, hog. Too good. It sped up 12.6% on a strong quarter for revenue growth over there. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 4.01%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You might have seen earlier this week that the pandemic did damage to student test scores across the country, reading and math. That is the not great news. The somewhat better news is that public schools do still have much of the $190 billion that they got in pandemic relief money left over. The thing is, the school districts have very long lists of things they need or want to spend that money on, and fractions and vocabulary aren't necessarily right at the top. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
When kids returned to school full-time last year at the Umatilla District in Eastern Oregon, they'd kind of forgotten how to be in school. Heidi Seip is superintendent there.
We saw students who were really having a hard time interacting with one another.
So Seip spent some of the $5 million her district received from the federal government on summer camps where kids could relearn how to socialize while kayaking and cooking with solar ovens. She also hired extra instructional coaches and substitutes. But once the federal money's gone, she doesn't know how she'll pay them.
No, I do not know. I would love to tell you, yes, this is my exact plan.
She has a deadline. Districts have until September 2024 to spend the last of their COVID relief funds. And when the latest round came through last year, the government said only 20% of that is required to be spent on learning recovery.
That 20%? That was a guess.
Marguerite Rosa directs the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown, which estimates about two-thirds of the federal money remains to be spent. She says districts are only just realizing how far behind students are.
The question now is, should we pivot and direct more of that money to remedying these deep learning gaps?
Unfortunately, there are some problems you can't just throw money at. Nick Poliak leads a school district in suburban Chicago.
If I wanted to say, I'm going to hire 100 more teachers, okay, I could use the money that way, but there's nowhere to put them. There aren't enough of those teachers to hire.
He says logistics make it hard to spend on instruction.
I couldn't possibly spend that amount of money on those kind of supports.
Instead, Poliak's planning to put the money towards updating the HVAC systems in schools that were built more than six decades ago. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
You know how when we talk about mortgages, we almost always talk about the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage? Yeah, well, that's a mostly American thing. Over in the UK, just for instance, home loans are way shorter term, anywhere between 2 and 5 years. So volatility in interest rates becomes a real thing. Oh, hello, the mini budget of former Prime Minister Liz Truss. Huge unfunded tax cuts, that is to say, tax cuts that would require a whole lot of government borrowing, which were greeted by the bond market with spiking interest rates. You see where I'm going here, yes? And sure, the Bank of England stepped in, but as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, the British housing market is spooked.
Buying his first home just north of London at the age of 26, Alex Nunn thought he was sitting pretty. But then came the mini budget and a big spike in mortgage interest rates.
We could be in a position where we can't afford to pay our mortgage. That's why it's so worrying at the moment. It's the not knowing. It's the uncertainty of what's to come.
Alex certainly faces the danger of losing his home. In January, his mortgage repayments could almost double when his $280,000 deal expires, and along with it, the interest rate of just over 3% that he fixed 2 years ago.
You plan whether you can afford it or not based on those rates at the time. Now, of course, there's a potential for them to go up, but to this level is unprecedented.
In fact, new mortgage rates here have been rising over the past year, but the mini budget gave them a further dramatic upward twist and sleepless nights for many homeowners like Bianca Hamdoui.
Oh, since the announcement of the mini budget, my mind has been in overdrive. I don't know what I will do.
As she told the BBC, Bianca's mortgage rate could more than double when her two-year deal ends next year. Already squeezed by the soaring cost of food, energy and fuel, this independent 34-year-old may be forced to take drastic action.
I was thinking about extreme situations as moving back to my parents and just letting my place out so I can keep it. I'm just running out of options.
Mortgage rates have come down a bit since the new Prime Minister and the new Finance Chief took over, but the mini-budget turmoil has raised worries. Three-quarters of outstanding British mortgages are on 2 or 5 year fixed-rate terms. Housing analyst Neil Hudson says that every month more than 100,000 Brits will be getting a nasty jolt.
It's going to be a big shock for those people whose fixed-rate mortgage is ending.
But why haven't the Brits opted for much longer fixed-rate terms like those 30-year American deals? The answer, says Hudson, is that short-term deals have been much cheaper, and when interest rates were declining, you could refinance at lower and lower rates.
I think it's kind of built into the British psyche that mortgage rates continue to go down, so you might as well have a short fixed-rate period and benefit from it.
Those days have now come to an abrupt end, which, says Samuel Toombs of Pantheon Macroeconomics, will have consequences for the wider economy.
Make no mistake about it, this is a huge shock to households' disposable incomes, and we will see that contribute to a recession in the UK next year.
As the era of easy money comes to an end, average prices are up by 22%. Due to the UK's short-term mortgage deals and the present political uncertainty, British homeowners do appear to be more than a little nervous. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Leland, Michigan is the last stop on our tour of small business retailers where Annie Lang Hartman runs Wild Letty, selling things like greeting cards and outdoor gear both in person and online.
We are physically ready for the holidays, maybe not mentally, but our inventory level is doing great.
I think we are a small business anomaly as far as not having to increase prices. A few things have increased for us, but only by a penny or two per product. I have three employees and myself, so we are a team of four, and we are going to stick with that through the holidays. Between packing orders in our office and keeping our Sutton's Bay locations staffed, we are looking pretty good.
Annie Lang Hartman, she and her store, Wild Letty, are up in Leland, Michigan. This final note on the way out today, saw this on Bloomberg, which in turn got it from data from LinkedIn, showing that we all might want to work remote, those of us lucky enough to have jobs where that's possible. But companies? Yeah, no. Here's the data. In February this year, 20% of jobs offered on LinkedIn were remote or had remote as an option. In September of this year, that is to say last month, down to 14%. And now, job applications, you ask? Last month, remote job listings got 52% of all applications. That is up from 50% back in February. All right, off we go. Here, though, your moment of economic context. You can file this one in the Market Forces folder. Remember all the stories about Europe's pending natural gas nightmare? Never mind. They have put so much nat gas in storage, the Europeans have, that they have what is called an oversupplied grid. Prices down more than 70% from their August highs. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostat, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.